Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm super excited to say we have a special guest on with us today, Matt Frazier. Matt has over 25 years of experience in real estate, private equity, and corporate finance, and is the founder and CEO of Jones Street Investment Partners, a vertically integrated multifamily real estate firm. In this role, Mr. Frazier is responsible for all aspects of the company's growth, including fundraising, deal sourcing, and the growth of the Jones Street team. Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here today.
I will kick you over to Omar to get us started here.
Excited to talk with you, Matt. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into finance, and what ultimately led you to founding Jones Street?
Sure, yeah. Literally, I come from central Pennsylvania. I attended Penn State back in the mid-90s. I was a liberal arts major, which I wouldn't trade for anything, but is another way of saying I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life when I got out of college. I took a job initially in New York working in public relations for ESPN, the magazine. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. and was a paralegal in a law and lobbying firm, thinking that I was going to go to law school. But as I sat in all those meetings with the attorneys, there was always one person on the phone who was more in charge than my bosses at the law firm, and that was always the business person on the other end of the line. And I wanted to be that person more than I wanted to be the lawyer. And so I decided to try to get into business and finance. I visited Boston and really fell in love with the area. And it worked out that I was introduced to someone in a bank credit training program back in the early 2000s. And I moved here and was accepted into a program at Fleet Bank. And that's how I started in finance. I did loan workouts for a couple of years in the dot-com aftermath, and then eventually found my way into the private equity and venture capital arm of the bank, Bank Boston Capital, which was actually the very first SBA license that the government had ever issued. I was there when Bank of America bought Fleet, and I did that for most of the 2000s, but that's how I honed my investment skills. We ended up kind of shutting down that business. Bank of America needed to get out of the business entirely. I had started doing some real estate investing on my own, and I used that opportunity as we were shutting down Bank Boston Capital to just take my investment skills and my experience broadly in finance and just apply it to a different asset class, and that was real estate. I'd been doing it on my own for a period of time and ended up applying it at another firm until I was fortunate enough to find some partners to help me get Jones Street off the ground back in 2014.
Going from the shelter of an established firm to wanting to do something completely on your own, was that scary, exciting? What was the catalyst for giving you the confidence that there was room to grow and this was a space that you could get into and really drive at least that next leg of your career?
Both scary and exciting, and a lot of other things. And looking back at it all again, I sometimes question my own sanity. At the time I started Jones Street, I had two little kids and was building a house, and I now have four kids. So there's a lot of life stuff going on at that time. But to be honest, it's in my blood. My parents, my grandparents all were entrepreneurs, small business owners. I just always had that itch to try, to take the chance and try to prove myself. And for better or worse, I always felt that I could maybe do it better than somebody else, or at least wanted to see if I could. And so when the opportunity came along, it wasn't brand new to me. We'd been trying to do it. My current business partner, Matt Rinaldi, whom I met at Penn State, we had tried a few times over the years to try to get something off the ground. And in 2014, when the window kind of opened, people like say to me, wow, that was so fortunate and you were so lucky to get that chance. And I was. But I also like to say I was ready for it. I'd been working at it for a long time. When that window opened, I was not unprepared.
Matt, how about you tell us a little bit about Jones Street? Maybe run us through what you guys have in your portfolio, what your team looks like. Tell us a bit about the company.
Sure. We are based in Boston. We are a multifamily owner and operator. We focus exclusively on the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions of the United States, which makes us pretty unique in our space. We've done that intentionally from the beginning, and it was a well-thought-out thesis that I think has been pretty well-proven over the last 10 years, in particular over the last two or three. We are vertically integrated, so we manage all of our own assets as well. We have an in-house property management platform. From the start, back in late 2014, we've grown today to be about 6,500 apartment units with a portfolio spanning Maine to Virginia, about $2 billion of real estate altogether, and somewhere pushing about 200 employees in total across the entire organization.
What is it that differentiates you guys from some other firms that might operate in the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast? What's kind of that investment philosophy?
Well, the foundation of the philosophy goes to a really central premise. And real estate is not a complicated business at its soul. It's about supply and demand. And our contention in multifamily in our regions was that there's a lot of capital over the years, and particularly over the last couple of economic cycles, that have chased opportunities in kind of higher growth markets in the South, understandably, and it's for that growth. But I don't know that people fully pay attention to the other side of that supply and demand equation there, which is about the supply. These are very low barriers to entry markets. It applies broadly and also specifically to real estate. And they can become oversupplied really quickly. And when that oversupply happens, it tends to coincide with down cycles in the economy. And so you have this combination of deteriorating operating fundamentals along with deteriorating capital markets, and it creates a lot of cyclicality in the investment returns. And that's just not a risk that we have in our business. We have other risks for sure, but we are so chronically undersupplied in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, it's systemic. And so we can take that risk off the table when we're looking at investment opportunities. From there, we take a very value-oriented approach to all the things that we look at. And being here in Boston, based in the Northeast with the local relationships and in the flow of information, there are very few firms like ours who check all those boxes, do all those things, who are owners, operators. We're also developers who are based here with local relationships. It makes us pretty unique in this business.
Yeah, so it's something I wanted to follow up on too, because I think it's chronically difficult to build on the West Coast, but it sounds like you guys have those relationships with folks in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic, and in your kind of Boston and DC areas. It wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with certain markets in the West Coast. I do know generally the point is the same, which is you have kind of regulatory environments, landlocked areas, scarcity of land, very active local communities who, for better or worse, are going to be very engaged on a lot of the development activity. All of these things just make development harder. And that makes the addition of supply harder. And that creates that supply and demand imbalance. There's a couple of statistics to back it up, but broadly, over the last 30-something years, going back to about 1990, the population of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, I think it's grown around 7 million people, but less than 5 million housing units have been permitted. And that's this kind of systemic build of that supply and demand imbalance. It's got a lot of things that are not good, that are negatives for local economies, but for a multifamily developer and owner-operator, that's a good thing.
Do you find that the markets you've chosen may be somewhat less susceptible to macro swings and cycle movements? You're an owner, operator, and developer. Do you find that you're shifting your strategy between those focuses of your firm throughout the cycle?
That's a good question. We want to be consistent in the way that we're approaching those, because I'm certainly not smart enough, and we as a firm are not smart enough to know exactly where we are in a given cycle and time it perfectly. And so I actually don't want to introduce that risk to our business and to our investors. Having said that, the last couple of years, development has been pretty hard to do. So has acquisitions. It's just been a difficult environment, period for the last couple of years in the capital markets. But we've looked at a lot of developments over the last, call it 3 years, where the cost to develop it was more than the value created in the development itself because of input costs between labor and materials being so high that you could not make the math work. We knew that that would change eventually. And so we didn't necessarily just kill any development opportunity just because. We kept them active, we kept them engaged, we kept looking at them and waiting for fundamentals to start to turn, and they are now. We know that kind of mid next year in our regions here in the Northeast, we'll be at about a 15-year low of new supply of multifamily hitting the market. And that's a really good time to actually be delivering multifamily into that environment. So we've been trying to position ourselves to play the opposite ends there as that cycle goes, but also not trying to be so smart that we think we can time it perfectly.
I would think that there are a lot of benefits from playing in all of those areas and the vertical integration that your firm has, because you do have a kind of a direct lens into your markets. Are there any examples that you could highlight that really bring color to the benefit of that deep view that your firm has?
Well, yeah, I mean, we get a great benefit just by having that team fully integrated in here, where if there's a development project and we're leasing and leasing for whatever reason is slow for a week or two or three, everyone can come together real time and have a discussion on why and make quick determinations on, is this something that's just a temporary thing that happens to be going on here with our asset or this local submarket or the weather or whatever it is? Or is there something that we're seeing here that we're also seeing at other assets across the portfolio where we can start to draw some broader conclusions? We've developed and we continue to develop internal processes and communication flows so that we can monitor those things real time and be better learners across all parts of our business. We're not always perfect at it. It's an ongoing process, but it's part of building a business and improving as we go.
That makes a lot of sense. Looking over at the sources and uses side or the capital stack, how are you usually funding your projects? Are you relying on agency, local banks? I figure if you're a known kind of regional player, you probably have a number of established connections with investors and lenders. But can you speak a bit to your capital stack?
Yeah. On the debt side and in development specifically, and then I'll talk about stabilized kind of value add and core plus stuff. But on the debt for development, that is usually going to be bank driven. And we have the benefit here in New England of having a very active and broad local and regional banking network. So we generally are going to have a lot of choices and a lot of banks that are going to express some form of interest or some level of interest in being engaged on the construction financing. On the stabilized assets and sticking with debt, we are primarily agency borrowers. We're going to be going to Fannie and Freddie. Those are not easy institutions to get to know initially if you haven't done it before. The processes are rigorous and come with a lot of boxes to check. But we've done it many times. We've got great relationships with both agencies and the various lenders that they work with. And we are generally going to be going there for our debt financing on a stabilized deal. On the equity side, there's an evolution that we've had in our business. When we started, we were really just a syndication shop. I mentioned my partner, Matt Rinaldi. We are also partnered with a family office in the Midwest. And we were syndicating our deals one by one as we went with our collective network. As we've grown, our investor network grew both in its size and also in its sophistication. And we count a lot of very large and sophisticated individuals and family offices as our investors now. And that has continued to grow as well, where we are doing more and more institutionally, where JV partners with or JV structures with institutional partners. And we're in process now of transitioning all the way into an institutional capitalization structure where we're going to have dedicated vehicles for development, value add, and core plus. Those will be maybe JV structures, a traditional commingled fund, and on the core plus side, eventually kind of a long dated private REIT structure. they're necessary to support the growth of the business. We can't continue to grow and do what we do best while also syndicating every single deal. It's too cumbersome and it's too expensive. And I don't think the investors really like hearing from me that often anyway, or at least not when I'm asking them for money on a new deal. So we're trying to figure out better ways to grow our business, structure our investments, and maintain those great relationships with our investors.
So Matt, backing up a little bit, I know you gave us a nice overview of some of the type of product that you have, but I was wondering, do you see yourselves targeting a very specific type of like tenant or resident profile? I know you have this geographic focus, you guys do a lot of development. Who are you targeting for your typical kind of resident profile?
Well, you know, we try to think thematically, and that can change depending on what's going on in the world. And I guess the best way to like really fully answer your question is through an example. A few years ago, as we were coming out of the pandemic lockdowns, we were looking at the landscape around us. There was a lot of capital when we reopened back in late 2020 and all through 2021 that was looking to do deals. And they were really migrating to a strategy that we had always employed, which was we've always focused more suburban secondary markets than we have on the urban core. And our thesis on that was always something we call core rental demand without core investment demand, where we can show empirically over long periods of time, here's this suburb, here's this secondary city. The rental fundamentals here, if you put them with a no name at the top of the chart and compared it to Boston or New York, fundamentals look identical, if not better, but it's not as deep of an investment market because a lot of investors don't know where Portland, Maine is, or Manchester, New Hampshire. When we got out of the lockdown and capital wanted to go to less dense areas because the perception was that's where everyone wants to go live now, capital was flooding into, frankly, our assets. And so we saw a ton of interest on the sell side where we could sell and take advantage of a lot of that capital interest. But on the buy side at the same time, we were looking around and saying, where do we want to be active investors right now? And we had a thesis that there was a renter profile that was actually going to be doing quite well at that time. There was a profile of worker, a white-collar worker who had kept their job but was working from home, saving a lot of money because they weren't commuting, they weren't traveling, they weren't spending, probably receiving some government stimulus, maybe even in a position to demand pay increases from their employer because of the tightening job market. And so we said, where does that person live? They're going to tend to live in higher earning zip codes in Class A properties. And so that's what we started to target in 2021. And we were doing so at the exact same time when rates were still really low. And so we could buy high quality new vintage assets with high earning residents and finance them on a fixed rate basis with really low cost debt. And we made a series of investments back in 2020, 2021. That fit that theme that are all now doing quite well. Later, that started to shift as the economy was rebounding and there was a lot of job growth. A lot of that job growth was happening in more of the service-oriented kind of blue-collarish space. And so we started to look more actively at workforce housing at that time, more Class B properties where we could think about a value-add strategy. A long-winded answer to your question, but it's more thematic. And based on what's going on in the world, there's no one thing ever that we're focused on.
I like that as an intro to my follow-up question, which is if that was kind of driving the post-pandemic investment thesis and transition a bit to this kind of blue-collar, maybe secondary, tertiary market for workforce housing, what do you see as the big driver now? Are you guys looking at something fundamentally different? Are you going back to those core strategies or is it something entirely different?
Yeah, now it's really interesting. The capital markets in our business have been stressed, if not in a recession of some sort, for the last 2 or 3 years, really since interest rates spiked in response to inflation running up. So, you know, kind of go back to mid-2022. There's not been a lot of transaction activity, or at least compared to historical averages, not as much transaction activity. The reasons for that were many, and most fundamentally in our markets, when you have a lot of interest rate volatility and it's hard to understand as a buyer, what is my terminal value here? Because I don't know what a terminal cap rate is going to be. therefore I need to price in that risk, and my value on an asset that I'm going to look to buy has to be lower so that I can make sure that I've got some margin of safety and get compensated for that risk on the other end. That was driving down the bid, but on the ask in our market, fundamentals are still great. We're highly occupied in our portfolio in 2023. I think our rents grew 6 or 7% last year. Across our whole portfolio, our rents grew 5.5%. And so if you're not a forced seller into that market, if you don't have a debt maturity or a fund maturity or some other balance sheet issue that is causing you to consider a sale and you can wait that out, then you do. Because particularly again, in our markets, our fundamentals are so strong. And if our value has gone down now, it's going to come back later because I'm going to grow my way out of it. Now that game, I'm not going to say it's up, but people have less ability to wait because eventually debt does mature and capital needs to be returned to investors. And there are a lot more sellers coming back to the market. There's not just a lot of pent up buyer demand. There's a lot of pent up sales demand. And some of those deals are going to come to market because of a balance sheet issue where the original business plan has not been fully realized for whatever reason. And so what we have been focused on for some time now is finding those opportunities where we can buy good real estate and we might be paying a market valuation for it, but there's so much underlying value there to be realized. And you need to be an operator to be able to execute on that, to actually, you know, after acquisition, go in and unlock that value. We are. So we think we're well positioned in this kind of deleveraging cycle that we're entering into to find a lot of really compelling opportunities, particularly on the value add side.
Are you guys seeing any signs of softening demand for your particular kind of unit product? Sounds like you guys have done a good job of shifting to meet the demand, but is there anything on the horizon you think that might actually put a dent in general demand for multifamily housing?
The short answer is no. We're so far this year, and we've been preparing for a recession for the last 3 years and have yet to see any sign of it. So far this year, that remains true. Rents are up across our portfolio. Demand continues to be strong. Spring leasing traffic is strong. And here in the Northeast, this is the time of year where you really see that activity pick up. We are also in some stage of lease up of four different development projects, one recently just completed. And so three others where we're still approaching the finish line on the lease up. And those are all going really well this spring too. So no, we're not seeing any sign of weakness yet, but there's a lot of uncertainty in the world and that risk is out there and we're going to be prepared for it.
So I did want to ask you about some recent writing that you did. And we had talked about this before we jumped on the call here, that you posted a piece in Forbes entitled How Northeast and Mid-Atlantic Real Estate Developers Can Help Drive Multifamily Housing Growth. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that piece and tell us kind of your thesis on, you know, what the possible solutions are to the housing crises that do impact Northeast and Mid-Atlantic?
Yeah, happy to. And thank you for asking. I won't pretend to have all the answers, and I don't know who's listening to me anyway, but I do have some ideas on it. First and foremost, I think the development community, the developer community, needs to be better listeners. It's really easy to hear community objections and disagree with them on their merits. And look, I am a developer. I'm not going to agree generally with a lot of community municipality pushback on increased traffic or burdens on schools or that kind of stuff. But I'm also not going to dismiss them out of hand because, well, I might not believe they're well-reasoned. I have had enough of these conversations over the years with folks to understand that they are at least well-intentioned. And spending the time paying people the respect of actually listening to what their concerns are, hearing their point of view, and really trying to understand their point of view, it means something. And even if I'm not ultimately going to agree with them in the end, the act of sitting down and engaging and listening, I might pick up something that is meaningful. And I try to approach it with everybody. I've said to a lot of communities and community groups and individuals over the years as we've been developing projects that I promise you I will listen. I can't promise you that I'm going to do everything that you're going to ask. And I'm not going to be able to satisfy every request that you make, but I am going to promise you that I'm going to listen, I'm going to try. And that act of engagement can really create relationships that ultimately can lead to successful developments. We literally just yesterday finished the final closing on a parcel of land here in Boston. And it was a development process, an entitlement process that we began 2 years ago. It took us 2 years to do it. The city of Boston does not make it easy to do business and to develop new multifamily product here. And this particular parcel at the intersection of South Boston and the Seaport District, this is not a neighborhood that's really known for new projects. They're not going to be blanket receptive to anything new coming in. But we took a lot of time to engage and listen and learn. And it was through that process that we were able to iterate the design of our project, but build relationships that ultimately led to its approval. And we're going to be really excited, hopefully later this year, by the end of the summer, to have some shovels in the ground and start building that project, which is going to be 236 new units right behind the convention center in Boston. And so that's the first one. It's getting rid of this kind of development. There's always a winner and a loser mentality. Let's find win-win situations for everybody. The second idea that I've had is that from a political governmental perspective, it can't just be sticks, a stick and an enforcement. There needs to be some carrots for development. Massachusetts in particular, like all states across the country, was flush with pandemic stimulus. And there was a real missed opportunity in my mind to use some of that money to spur new development. And it can take the form, it doesn't have to be direct. I think most appropriately would come in the form of some property tax relief, where that stimulus money could actually subsidize property tax payments so towns can be made whole on the property taxes of a new development, or even maybe something in addition to being made whole, but taking that burden off the developer so that the developer has an incentive, a financial incentive, to come in quickly, deliver good product for local towns, while towns can benefit from the added tax revenue. But particularly here in Massachusetts, where the MBTA communities law was put in place, it's become very controversial. It's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. It's very much an enforcement-oriented law, where it's you either comply or we're going to withhold cash. And that hasn't been enough for some towns to say yes to it. There needs to be actually some incentive as well. And again, it's finding win-win scenarios for everyone. I think people need to kind of throw out the old playbook and come together to say, this is a problem. We're all impacted by it in different ways. How can we work together to create win solutions for everybody?
And Matt, I know that one of the major themes that's been affecting the multifamily space over the last probably 2-3 years has been the topic of insurance. Is that a challenge in your market in terms of the pricing and availability of insurance? And is that something that's been on your radar that you're still paying attention to?
Very much, yeah. Insurance is far and away the most volatile line item in our operating expense structure. We don't have here the same concerns as folks in higher risk areas like in the state of Florida might have in terms of actually getting the insurance. We can do that. But on a year-to-year basis, our premiums can be up 50%, down 11%, up 30%, up 10%. It's just all over the place. And it makes it really, really difficult to underwrite a new investment when that's happening. And again, we have it better than other places. Now, I would say in some of those other places, what's happened over the last few years has actually been right-sizing the true cost of owning real estate in those markets, that the cost of owning in a high-risk area like Florida that's susceptible to storms might have been underpriced for a long time. And that's right-sizing itself now. But in some ways, the rest of the world is paying for that because the insurance companies need to push that premium out on. I'm far from an expert on this, but it's a really frustrating place for us to be in, where we have such a meaningful line item in our expense structure and we have such little clarity and zero control over it. And it's insurance. You get to a point where you actually pay them a lot of money to perform a service. And then when you ask them to perform the service, they do everything they can to deny it. That's a pretty difficult thing to endure.
Do you think if we just called the topic of insurance a problem, are we close to finding a solution? Or is that you've accounted for the volatility and are assuming that it's going to be volatile for the foreseeable future?
From an underwriting perspective now, we are taking a very conservative stance on it, where we're starting at a high premium rate and assuming an aggressive annual increase going forward. From a strategic perspective, we're exploring alternative ways of removing that altogether, which could involve things like self-insuring or setting up captive insurance.
And are there ways that you are adjusting your portfolio to find ways to offset that expense, whether that's through potential rent growth additive measures that could be maybe adding certain amenities to the property or different services that could ultimately be charged for, but could ultimately help offset that new larger line item?
Yeah, we're trying to do that anyway. If we have a value add strategy and it involves clubhouse renovations or unit interiors, that's going to be part of the business plan anyway. We haven't gone so far, and it would not be legal to write in this is your insurance surcharge to a resident. I'm not sure that the state regulatory bodies would allow that. But we are trying to, and I don't think this isn't appreciated enough. There's been a lot of focus over the last few years on the increasing cost of housing, and landlords get painted sometimes pretty negatively because rents are going up by so much. Without focusing on our insurance premium just went up 50% and our taxes went up 20% and our utility bills are going up 20%. And yes, our rent might be going up 10%, but it might not even be keeping pace with the way that our expense structure is going up. We have to do some of that stuff, but it's also part and parcel of the business plan anyway.
And taking a step back and looking at another area of interest now is the political and geopolitical changes that are either being discussed or actually happening that have been really rocking the markets. I'm sure this is stealing some of your attention, whether it's coming from questions from investors or lenders, but I suspect you're also discussing it in-house, whether that's trade policy, tax, or big local zoning changes. Which of these topics have got your attention? And how would you break them down, or how are you making sense of those?
That's a really good question, Omar. For the last couple of years, from a policy regulatory perspective, the thing that captured most of our attention was efforts toward rent control. A natural political response to raising rents broadly in a market is for a politician to say, we need to control that. And we happen to be in business in a lot of blue states, and that is a risk. And so we've had to stay very mindful of that. And it's been more present in some markets than others, but it was something that we were worried about broadly across our portfolio. I think that we might be on the other side of that now. Very happily, there's been kind of refreshing dialogue from both sides of the aisle, understanding that really the way to get out of this issue is through more supply. It really is about supply and demand, which is something that we've, of course, known for a long time. But it didn't seem like a lot of politicians wanted to recognize that or at least acknowledge it publicly. But that has gotten some more airtime, and that's refreshing. And so I think a lot of those regulatory pushes and conversations on rent control, at least from where we sit, have been slowing down or dying down. Now, obviously, like everyone, we're kind of transfixed by what's going on in Washington, D.C., and with the tariffs. We just sent actually a note out to our investors last week on how we think this will impact our business if the tariffs are to go through the way they've been proposed. Perversely, I think it might actually be somewhat helpful, although I'm certainly not supportive of it for the uncertainty that it's brought, because that has caused a lot of people to just withdraw entirely until we understand better what's going on. But I think as we look at ourselves as developers, tariffs will certainly have an impact on a lot of our input costs, from steel and lumber to electrical components, certain manufactured products. by our estimate, and it's very hard to estimate because the numbers are moving all the time, by our estimate, it could impact the cost of a development by maybe up to 3%. And that 3% impact would have about a 25 basis point swing on our yield, meaning if we thought we were going to build a project to a stabilized cap rate of a 7, now it might be a 6.75 because the cost went up. But if you look at stabilized assets, I think tariffs actually, if they're going to do anything, they might actually be helpful to the valuation of stabilized assets. And it's because of that impact on development. If it slows down development or at least creates uncertainty on new development that causes some people to take a step back, that only is going to make existing product more attractive by comparison. And if the cost of new development does in fact go up, replacement cost, as you think about stabilized product, is going to be more attractive too. So I think this could be that combined with that reopening that I was talking about before, where there's a lot of pent-up sales demand in addition to pent-up investment demand. And we're seeing that actually pull cap rates lower over the last 6-7 months. Those things combined can create enough cushion in between stabilized valuations and the yield that you need to see on a new development to actually allow some of those developments to continue. But the problem really is the uncertainty right now, and the kind of on again, off again nature of it. It's really hard for people to understand how to underwrite something and how to commit capital to something when you don't know what the rules are going to be tomorrow. So that's what we're kind of waiting out.
And diving into another topic that is uncertain, and at least over the last couple decades, been on again, off again, potential agency or GSE privatization. Do you have any views on that?
I'm generally going to be in support of privatization. I think when it comes to the GSEs, execution is the key. If it's going to happen, it needs to be done very carefully and with a lot of thought and intention. That is not something that I have a lot of confidence in right now, based on what I see in other areas of government in Washington, D.C. So that would make me nervous. Again, as a concept, philosophically, I think it's a good idea, but it would need to be done so that there's not a lot of disruption, not just to our space in the multifamily market, but in certainly more importantly, in the single family residential market. It just needs to be done with a lot of care.
So Matt, we've already talked about a handful of, I guess we'll call them like CRE related challenges. Inflation is still around, possibly back on the table. Interest rates are still elevated. There's a lot of uncertain trade policy. Are there any pressure points that you're working on or in CRE that others don't? Or the alternative would be, do you see those creating any opportunities?
Yeah, I think most fundamentally, something that we touched on before is just that deleveraging cycle that we're in and really just beginning. You mentioned interest rates. I think interest rates are going to stay higher for longer. I think everyone's come around to that point of view. It's going to mean that valuations for a lot of sellers are not going to be what they wanted. And those balance sheet sales are going to create a lot of opportunity. That is going to be the pressure point. I know just anecdotally from speaking to people who are active in other regions of the country that I don't want to use the word reckoning lightly, but where you have debt issues forcing transactions while you also have poorer fundamentals, distress is starting to really take shape in some of those other markets. And those that have capital will really be able to identify and close on a lot of really attractive opportunities now. We're not likely to see that as much in our markets because, again, of our fundamentals, the supply and demand imbalance. But we will still find opportunities because of those balance sheet issues. So that is the pressure point for the next couple of years, I think, and it is the opportunity. And it's real estate, and it's very interest rate sensitive, and that's where it begins and ends.
We've been talking a lot about core CRE concepts of markets, how properties are performing, and different product within the market, and you've shed a lot of excellent perspective on those topics. But another big area that is in focus is the excitement around technology. Whether it's AI or any new tech that is available, is that something that you are applying across your portfolio, or within your investment teams?
Where I think AI is, or just technology generally, is likely to make the most meaningful impact in our space is in development. And again, thinking about tariffs and development getting more expensive, more inefficient, more cumbersome, that's where the low-hanging fruit is going to exist. And whether that's 3D printing or modular construction, more efficient design, anything that you can do to speed up that process, I think long-term, that's where new technology is going to be the most disruptive in a good way. On the stabilized side, in the property management and operating side, there's certainly a lot of prop tech that's out there, you know, from the rent algorithms to key systems to how do we get smarter on screening residents, talking to residents. There's a lot of stuff, and it's all potentially powerful. I also think a lot of it is at the margins. And we've actually, while exploring and even utilizing some of it, particularly on the leasing side, continue to try to lean in the opposite direction, though. This is still a people business. Property management is a client service business, a customer service business. When you have a leaky faucet, you're not sending a robot to repair the leaky faucet. You're sending a trained maintenance technician to do that. And ideally one with a smile and good customer service. When you're knocking on a door and asking about a room to rent, a unit to rent, there is not a bot that is sitting behind the desk. That's a human being. And so we want to continue to lean into the real face-to-face communication and the customer service part of the property management side. That's not ignoring any of the efficiencies that tech can provide us. We're very interested in it, and we want to continue to apply it, if only to make the customer service better. Ideally, it makes our properties more profitable too. But we have to continue to remember that this is still a human being business, and we are in the business of providing people housing. And that's incredibly important. We have to treat that with the respect that it deserves, because this is where people build families and host holiday meals and form lifelong relationships. And we want to create communities where people want to be. And so when we're offering them a renewal notice, they want to accept it because they don't want to leave. They want to do everything they can to stay there, and they're going to recommend it to their loved ones and their friends and their family. We don't do that with robots. We do that with people. And so we're going to continue to focus on that.
Matt, I love that answer. And I do want to thank you for being with us today. We have one more question, and this is one that we ask all of our guests. So as a CRE or multifamily professional, if you could snap your fingers and have some change to the industry come true, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a lot of inefficiencies in our business that kind of drive me nuts, and I wish I could make them go away. But if I did, I realized that I would make a lot of the inefficiencies that we're trying to capitalize on go away, and some of my opportunity would be lost. And so I guess the answer, where we are in a world where liquidity is still drier than it should be, or at least we'd like it to be, I'd love to get the loan assumption process with the agencies to be back to what it used to be, a kind of 45, 60 day process, rather than what has become like a 3 or 4 month process. It's just slowing down the transaction market, gumming up the works unnecessarily. I don't truly understand what the issue is, if it's understaffing or being overburdened with too many of the deals or something else. I've heard all the answers to it, but I'd just love to get that process to be a little bit quicker so we could increase transaction volume, free up some capital, and everybody could keep buying and selling and making the world go round.
Excellent. Well, Matt, thank you so much for being with us. I do think that's all the time that we have, but really want to thank you and our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.